Yeah, don't pick us up, I think. Okay, we're talking today with John Blanchard, ex-Major League ball player, spent most of his career with the Yankees. John, let's take you way back to the early days. Ask you to remember, if you could, who was the scout that first scouted you and signed you to your contract, your first contract?
Joe, that was a fellow by the name of Joe McDermott. Joe was lived in Iowa City, Iowa, and I was from Minneapolis, and that was Joe's territory. I had gone away, when I was a junior in high school, I went away to Carroll, Iowa to play semi-pro in the Iowa State League. And of course, I got to see Joe, you know, it's right in his backyard, so I got to know him pretty good. And then when I went back to Minneapolis my senior year in high school, after that, then I signed with the Yankees.
How did you first get started in baseball? Was it through Little League or town ball type of program?
Well, Joe, it was back in those days, they didn't have Little League. And they had junior baseball, what we call midget baseball, or I guess it was about the same thing. And the big thing, the key as far as I was concerned, was I was able to play on more than one team when I was growing up. So when I was 10 years old, I'd be playing with the 14-year-olds and so on. So I'd play, like on a Saturday at Minneapolis, I would play on four different teams.
Wow.
And four different ball fields. It was nothing to play three different teams and three different ball fields. And you can't do that today, Joe. This is an example, I think, of too well of an organized program. You're dictated to when you can play, when you can have the field. Your practice is like 2 or 3 days a week. And there's no way that you can turn out a major league ball player by that routine.
Was there a specific person who influenced you, got you started playing as a child, as a kid?
Well, I had a brother, Don, and he was a bat boy for the old Minneapolis Millers.
Wow.
In AAA. Of course, he loved the game, and I would say that he was the biggest influence because, gosh, we used to play. Well, we'd leave, we'd be up at the park at 7 in the morning, and I would miss lunch if, you know, at home, and many, many times I'd miss supper. I'd get home at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. But I'd go from baseball all day long. There's nothing else to do in the local park there. In the playground system, we'd start a softball game. But, you know, and then when that got old, we'd go back to baseball. We played ball 7 days a week. You know, there was no television. Mm-hmm. There was no money. There was the only thing you had going for you was you played ball. So I loved it. And I would say my brother, the one that had influence on me.
Was your family as a whole behind you playing that much and trying to make a career of it at that point in time?
Oh, sure. Mom used to get rather upset, you know, when you'd miss supper and things like that. And the park was only half a block away, and I could hear her yelling at me, you know, to come and eat. But God rest her soul, she was good. They, you know, they stuck. I guess maybe they'd rather see me there, you know, playing ball. They knew exactly where I was and what I was doing than in trouble someplace.
I don't blame them there. Now, you said you played a lot of games. Did you also play a lot of positions growing up, or were you a catcher from the very beginning?
No, Joe, I never caught until I got to pro ball.
Really?
Yeah, I was a third baseman pitcher most of my career in high school, and so it's amazing, you know, when I signed when I was 18 years old, I went right to Kansas City in AAA for a cup of coffee, of course. And they put me in left field. I'd never played the outfield, you know, in my life. And then the next year, I went to an instructional league, and Bill Dickey made me he got permission from Casey Stengel to work with me as a catcher. Now he's the one that changed I put Elson Howard behind the plate, and he put Yogi Berra behind the plate, and he put me behind the plate. So he said to me, do you think you'd like to catch? And I says, well, if you think I can get to the big leagues, I said, sure, I'll give it a try. So that's how that happened.
So you started off as a pitcher, third baseman for the Yankees then, in high school?
No, just in high school. I played third base and did some pitching. And then the Yankees signed me. But in Carroll, Iowa, when I was down in a semi-pro league, I didn't pitch at all. I just played third base, and that was it. And that's why they signed me.
So the Yankees signed you out of Carroll, Iowa?
Yeah, right.
And then you went to Kansas City for a cup of coffee?
Yeah.
Instructional led with Dickey. And then the next year, I think, did they send you down to Binghamton?
Joplin, Missouri. Yes, as a catcher. Yeah.
Was that a full-time catching thing for you at that point?
Yes.
Catching full-time?
You bet. Yeah.
Was it a tough transition for you because you had just maybe learned it that club before that?
No, you know, as long as you're playing, Joe, you're playing a position, and the position itself, there's a lot to learn behind the plate. But it was fun. And I didn't care what they said. If they wanted me to play center field, yeah, it made nervous to me. I didn't care. As long as I was playing, you love the game so much that, heck, I'd go any place.
Tell me a little bit about the minor leagues at that point in time. It was the 50s, and you were a young guy, I guess maybe away from home for the first time. How did you adapt to minor league life?
Well, you know, it's an amazing thing, Joe. The last time a guy asked me that question, he worked for the New York Times. And he did a series Monday through Thursday in the New York Times on what it was like to be a Yankee rookie or in the minor leagues. So I went ahead and said what it was like in the minor leagues and so on. And I didn't mean it in a derogatory manner. I meant it, you know, when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, let's just play ball. How we get to the next ballpark is one thing. You know, that's part of it. The bus breaks down at 2 in the morning, you know, and the whole ball club's off the bus, pushing the bus. And you think nothing of it. You're eating the greasy spoons, the hamburger joints, and but you think nothing of it. And I wrote this writer wrote this article. Well, George Weiss, the general manager of the Yankees, called me in the office. And boy, did he lower the boom on me. I mean to tell you, and I couldn't imagine what in the world he was upset about. And he was upset to the point where he said, you know, we're out there trying to sign these young players, and their parents are reading this. And he said, that would be a big turnoff. And he said, you keep your mouth shut and don't you ever write anything like that again. Boy, oh boy, that was the end of that. So I hadn't heard that question since, 1956, I guess it was, 57, somewhere in there.
I know that you spent, I think, about 9 years all told in the minors. How were the coaches and the managers that you played for in the minors at that point in time? Do you feel they helped to develop you?
Well, yeah, they, the instructional league, and then the day of a game, if you're having a rough go, they'll have an early practice during the week or whatever it is, and extra batting practice, and in the instruction they give you, you learn how to play the game. See, a lot of fellas, maybe I shouldn't say this, but there's a lot of ball players in the major leagues today that don't know how to play. They really don't know how to play the game. They sure as hell don't know how to run bases. And so I don't know. We learned the hard way back then, and it was much more difficult to get to the big leagues then. And you spent a lot of time in the bushes, and it was just a different ball game. All the managers I played for, each one of them helped me in a certain way, you know.
How about the front office personnel at that time in the minors? A lot of, I guess, like independent type guys. Any kind of funny stories or run-ins that you had with those guys? Were they pretty much just towing the company line at that point in time for the Yanks?
Well, no. I think that the general manager, like at Joplin, the guy down there, we had a general manager that he was working on a shoestring, as is all minor league teams. Mm-hmm. And we used to put white shoe polish on our baseballs. You know, he'd break out a couple dozen balls for a game or a dozen, whatever. And if a batting practice ball wasn't too dark, he'd pull it out and put white shoe polish on it and throw it in as a game ball, you know. It was all right. The umpires didn't say a whole heck of a lot. You're not supposed to. And they looked down and said, hey, look, we can't afford it. You know, we can't afford we're losing too many balls, you know. There was a lot of, they had a lot of goofy things, promotion type thing. Remember they had a hole, and I played in Birmingham, Alabama. And Memphis had a hole in the fence, about a quarter inch diameter of a baseball. I don't know what that would be circumference wise. But you hit it in that hole, they had a little net in the back of it for $100,000, you know. Well, you couldn't do it, Joe, because the hole was bored straight in, and a fly ball coming down would have to, it wouldn't fit. Ain't nobody gonna hit a line drive that far, so it'll go straight in the wood, see? And boy, they just had big $100,000 hit the hole and this and that. Well, hell, we got a foot away and threw it straight in, see? And that fly ball could never get in. They had promotions like that. A lot of fun.
How about the fans back then in the minors? Get along with them okay?
They loved them. Yeah. Yeah, the fans were fantastic. They were good baseball fans in Joplin, Missouri, and Kansas City, of course. I played there. It was in the minor leagues and the major leagues, but those are fantastic baseball fans. Birmingham, Alabama was great baseball. I even played in Amsterdam, New York. You know, and these are all these people that patronized the minor leagues games were really good ball fans. Occasionally, once in a while, you'd get a guy that had one too many, and he'd have to talk about your family or something like that. But other than that, he had fun.
You mentioned you spent a lot of time at a lot of different ballparks on your way up to the majors. How about the teammates that you had in the minor leagues? I'm sure you played with a lot of different guys. A lot of rivalry at that time in the minors trying to get up. You said it was more difficult to get to the majors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, your hardest throwers, the hardest throwers are in the minor leagues. And even today, I think that's true. The only reason they're in the minor league, they got the 100 mile an hour fastball, but they don't know where it's going. And you, as a hitter in the minor leagues, you have no idea where it's going either. So you're a little loose in there at times too against certain guys. I mean, if you don't have an idea, that's not a good feeling when you go to bat.
I can believe that.
But so you're some of your best pitchers in the minors, and a lot of kids will never find the control that they need to get to the big leagues. And it's a sad thing, you know. I'll tell you a good example. It was Sandy Koufax.
Sure.
Now, Sandy, the Dodgers sent him to Caguas, Puerto Rico. And I played for San Juan. And the Dodgers gave the Caguas Ball Club instructions to pitch him and leave him in there for 9 innings. Oh, man, I think he threw a no-hitter against us. And we beat him 7-0. Can you imagine that? He hit me twice. He walked me twice. And gosh, I think he walked 17, or he got hit by 7. I know he hit about a half a dozen guys. But they just got instructions. Ben Garrity was the manager. And old Ben said, I got to leave him in there. I got instructions to pitch him, and he can't get the control from the bench. So he's there to stay.
That's funny.
The longest night I ever spent in my life.
Any other really funny or humorous events of your minor league career that really stand out like that come to mind right now?
Oh, Joe, there's each and every ball player's got a repertoire. I could write a book on the minor league thing. Other than oh, lights go out, blackout, fifth inning. Somebody didn't pay the bill and they turned the lights out. Those are all, that's routine. Mm-hmm. Guys getting married at home plate. You know, that was pretty good, and everybody that come to the park had to bring a gift. We all laughed at the time. Yeah, it was a hell of a, it was a great idea. The bride and groom made out like bandits, you know.
Sure.
That was a good idea. But I got, there's a lot of things that happen, and I just can't think of anything
sure.
right off the top of my head.
When you finally made it up to the Yankees for full time, was there special circumstances surrounding your call up at all, or was it just you went to spring training and made the team that year?
No, I tell you what I did. I went to Denver. I played AAA in Denver and in 57 and 58, and I had good year in 57. I had what the you had the confidence, Joe. I had the confidence. I went to spring training in 58, and I had all kinds of confidence. As a matter of fact, the Yankees in spring training would give a gold watch to the rookie of the camp, the guy that had the best spring. Well, I won the gold watch, and I made all the cuts. I was heading north, and we went to Greenville, South Carolina, and played an exhibition game, and I made the axe fell there, and I missed it, missed me. So I got to Yankee Stadium opening day, and I says, man, I'm on my way. And I had a good spring, you know, and I was confident. And so I get there, and I get in the clubhouse. I haven't seen a ball field yet. So I get on here, and I get my socks on, and I put my supporter on. I got my sweatshirt on, and old guy by the name of Bill McCrory came over to me, and he said, hi, John. I said, hi, Bill, and I'm putting my sweatshirt on. He said, say, he says, can you catch? No, I looked up at him and I said, well, yeah, I'm not as good as Yogi Berra or Elson Howard, but I says, I can, if they got hurt, I could catch, sure. Oh, he said, good. And he reached in his pocket, he pulled out an airplane ticket, and he says, catch the next plane to Denver.
Oh, man.
Here it is. 30-some years later, it's funny now, but it sure as hell wasn't funny then, you know.
I can imagine, it must have been really difficult.
So off with the sweatshirt, and in the shower, and went to the airport, and went back to the minor leagues in Denver.
That's tough. Well, when you finally were called up for good, though, was it in 57?
Nine.
In 59?
Yeah.
Was it the same thing you had gone through, and you had finally made the cut, you were with the team to stay, is that basically what happened?
Yeah, well, what happened, and you see, each ball player at the time, I don't know what it is today, but we had three options. Each ball player went up, and they had another option left on me. Well, I didn't really think nothing of it, you know, at the time, because I was ready. There was no doubt in my mind. And but they had to keep somebody else, and because I had an option left, then they exercised their option and sent me down and kept the other fella, which, you know, that's the way the game was. I don't know if they have those today. I don't believe they do.
How would you, about the coaching when you got into the big leagues, was it the type of situation where they were able to help you out of a slump or help you with your fielding or throwing, or was it pretty much the guys were there in name only, the coaches?
The coaches then were more active, and I'll tell you something else, we respected them. I think, in fact I know, we had more respect for our coaches in the big leagues then than they do today. You know, it's a different ball game today. The baseball is, the game is the same, but it's the guys that are playing it that are different. You know, you make $3-4 million, you got $12 million contract. Joey, you're more concerned about your investments. You're more concerned about your oil investments, your construction, your development. God only knows what else. God rest his soul, Thurman Munson. He was really concerned. Of course, he's a great ball player now. But at the time, just prior to his day, he bought a Learjet, or I guess it was. And he was concerned about the business between Cleveland and New York, a commuter type thing for businessmen. Well, and it was because of money, you know, that, and I don't know, the coaching back when I played was, we respected their words and we listened to them. When a coach told you something, you did it. And by the time you got there, though, Joe, you better have had an idea how to play the game. That's what the hell they sent you to the minor leagues for. You learn the game, and by the time you get to the big show, you better have a good idea how to play baseball. And with the coaching that they have, that was just a plus.
What, or who was the person, or player, or manager that influenced you the most once you got into the majors? Was there someone who had a big influence in your career at that point in time?
Well, I think it was Ralph Houk. Ralph, I had played for Ralph in Puerto Rico and Denver, and we were good friends, still are good friends, and I think Ralph had a lot to do with, because I had played for him in the minors and so on, and hanging on with the Yankees.
Would you consider him the best manager you paid for? Because you also played for, like, I guess maybe Casey for a year or so,
yeah,
and Yogi for a year.
Yeah, I played for Casey, Yogi, Johnny Keene, and Houk. Yeah, I'd say Houk is the best. Houk is the best player, manager I ever played for. Yeah.
What would you say were Ralph's strengths as a manager?
Well, you know, Ralph had the knack. You know, 90%, Joe, 90% of managing is if you can keep your ball players happy. And if you can keep those guys in the right frame of mind, hey, that's 90% of managing. The other 10% is when to pull the pitcher. And Ralph had a knack of keeping everybody happy, super personality, you know, and when a ball player got down and everything, he could just come over and say a few words to you and pick you up right away, you know. And I would say his greatest asset was knowing how to handle men.
How about, you mentioned Casey and Yogi and Johnny Keene. If you could give me a little bit about some of your feelings on them and their strengths, given your situation at that time.
Well, Yogi was a good manager. He, you know, God knows he knew how to call a game, to manage a game, I should say. And he was good. He had a good ball club. We had a good ball club under Yogi. Good baseball man. Johnny Keene, I didn't know that much about him other than I knew him in the minor leagues. I played against him, and boy, he was a tough little manager to play against, because it seemed like, you know, he knew when to draw, when to pull the pitchers and so on, and make the right move, when to pinch hit and so on. John was a good manager. They were, you know, they were all good. Casey was an excellent manager. I think Casey introduced the platooning system. He really got into that back in the early 50s. And of course now it's percentage-wise, you know, the right-handed hitter is going to hit the left-handed hitter better than the left-handed hitter is going to hit a left-handed pitcher. So percentage-wise, he stuck to that pretty good, and had a great success in platooning. A lot of ball players didn't like it. They would rather hit against both left and right. But percentage-wise, Casey was right. And he used to make sense. He had good talent now, believe me. You know, I can talk about how great he was all day long, but you're only as good as your talent. I don't care what you do. And he had talented ball clubs. But no, he was a good manager.
Do you feel he was also pretty good at handling the players? Was that one of his strengths, you think?
Well, I can't really say that, because if silence is golden, then that's Casey. You know, he'd say hi to me in February. He'd say, "Hi, kid." And if he saw me leaving in October, he'd say, "Goodbye, kid." You know, and then, but, you know, that, you know, there's a situation where maybe it was good that he didn't spend that much time talking to the individual players. He didn't call that many meetings, and so, but Joe, what the hell can you do when you're in first place? I mean, you don't want to call a meeting and blow it. And you just might be in first place, call a meeting, and upset somebody and blow your standing. So, you know, you just want to shut up. If your ball club's in first place, don't say nothing to nobody.
When you put it that way, John, I think I might have to agree with you. Who was your favorite teammate when you were playing? Did you have one guy that really stuck out, that you guys got really close and helped each other a lot at all?
I would say Alston Howard. simply because I was friends with, you know, everybody. Mm-hmm. But Elston was a catcher, and he lockered next to me, and we would, all the time, we would talk situation, catching. And, you know, setting up a hitter. We would go over the ball club that we were playing that particular day. Maybe Ellie was catching, but we'd still talk about the hitters, and we had more conversation. We were, I would consider good friends, yeah, real good friends, simply because he's a catcher, but Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford and Yogi Bear and all of them, we were all really good friends. And
What about the ballparks? You played a lot of your games in Yankee Stadium. It's a pretty famous park. Was that your favorite park to play in at that point in time? Or did you have another ballpark that you seemed to do better or something?
There's no question about it. The best ballpark in baseball, whether it be in Japan or Holland or United States, the best park to hit in is Detroit. Tiger Stadium is an unbelievably great backdrop. You had the dark shadows in dead center field, and very high, and the ball, you could see it, you got a good look at it. You had the short porch in right field, left field wasn't that much further. That was the best park to hit in of all of them.
How would you classify yourself as a hitter, speaking of hitting?
Well, let me put it this way, Joe. Thank God for wood, because if I was going to make it to the big leagues on leather, buddy, I wouldn't even have been in the minors. I was in a role. I could call it now, looking back. I was a circumstance player, you know. I pinched hit a lot, and I would fill in a lot. Maybe Mickey or Roger Maris would. Some would give them a rest, or something would happen to them. Then I could go to left field or right field, and which we did in the World Series even. But I became accustomed to that, and especially pinch hitting. You know, I only had one shot when I went to bat, and if I blew it too many times, you know, I may be back in Joplin. So what I'm trying to say is I had a tendency to bear down maybe twice as much as a regular player. I only had one shot, and buddy, I had to make contact. And so I would really, really mentally set myself up to make contact, give the ball a play, hit it someplace. You know.
So basically you would consider yourself like a contact hitter, just slashing up there?
Yeah, I was no big average hitter, but I could, if it was a tight situation, I would, you know, I'd really talk myself into trying to get a piece of the ball, and I'd, you know, I'd come through once in a while.
Any special strategy on 0-2 when you're up there?
0-2 back when I played?
Uh-huh.
Well, you're about to hit the dirt. I mean, today it's against the rules of baseball for the pitcher to throw at you. Today, I'm going to tell you something, Joey. And I think I speak for every ball player that played prior to that rule. If I knew when I went to bat that that big turkey on that hill wasn't going to throw at me, I think I could have dug in a little bit deeper. And buddy, I could unbutton, instead of one button, I'd have buttoned two buttons and got it all. And because that's a pretty good feeling. I'd like to have 1 year knowing that he couldn't throw at me. And don't kid yourself, you know, they talk about little leaguers and legion of ball players in high school and so on. A lot of kids have a fear of the ball. And because it hurts when it hits, there's no getting around it.
Can hit.
Well, I'm going to tell you something else. I think the guys in the big leagues fear it more than, you know, I don't know. You learn to hang in there a little bit longer against the pitcher and so on. But buddy, it hurts just as hard when you get hit in the big leagues as it does in little league. Nobody likes to get hit, but I think that turned a lot of ball players off in their young years. You know, if they get hit the helmet, they didn't get hurt, but the ring inside the helmet the noise in there sounds like a freight train hits you. And that puts a fear in these little guys, and all of a sudden, they don't like the game anymore. They want to play soccer. And God bless them, I don't blame them at all. I mean, nobody likes to get hit.
What was any other strategies for particular situations when you went up there? As you said, because of your position on the team, you just were up there swinging, trying to hit the ball. For instance, I mean, you didn't get a chance to start that much, so you didn't think often that, you know, it's 3-0, or what would be your favorite situation as a hitter to be up there swinging the bat? What count would be your favorite count for you, personally?
Well, the count, if I look back, I think I was a better hitter with two strikes on me. You know, if I had a pitcher at 3-0 and I got the green light, Joe, invariably every time, I'd swing and miss, pop it up or ground ball or dub it or something. I don't know why. A lot of guys love to hit 2-0. They like to hit 3-1. No, I didn't. I'd rather hit 3-2. I'd rather hit 2-2. I'd rather, if I got two strikes on me, I don't know what it was. I knew that I couldn't afford another one. maybe that made me bear down more. But I'd rather hit with two strikes on me.
Do you think is there something for pro ball players that causes a slump? Is it a physical thing, or is it most of the time just mental, John?
Well, Joe, listen, buddy. If anybody knew the answer, man, I'd be a wealthy man today. I don't know. The guys have tried. You know, there's a lot of superstition. Not superstition, but idiosyncrasies goes around. You know, if a guy gets 4-for-4, now when he goes home at night, he has the same sandwich. He goes to bed at the same time. He watches the same TV program. Nothing changes. He takes the same route to the ballpark the next day, says hi to the same guy. You know, you try everything. And if you should get a couple of base hits that day, holy cow. But then that day comes, you do the same routine, you go to the park and you're 0-for-5, you know. So I don't know the answers. Nobody does. Boy, I sure wish they did, though.
Did you have your own special little idiosyncrasies, your own routine up there that when you were running on deck circle at all?
No, I didn't have, I didn't have any superstitions. What was this kid that played for Cleveland that had all, he had to go through a regular routine, fix his both shoulders, fix his cap in the front and the back.
Like Lenny Dykstra on the Phillies more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's a little routine that he goes through before he feels relaxed. You know, I never had that. I mean, I didn't have to fix my shirt or anything each pitch. No, I didn't have to do that. A lot of guys do it. Hey, it works. Lenny's in the big leagues.
Did pretty good last year, too.
Yeah.
Do you think that, like, the managers or the hitting coach can harm a hitter if he's kind of in a slump by trying to get him to changing and this sort of stuff at all? Or are they giving you that sort of advice? Or are they just trying to go with you and hope that you'll come out of it yourself?
Well, Joe Weaver, that's a touchy subject. There's been pros and cons about an overkill on a coach's part. The guy that's hitting 300, leave him alone. You don't go. But if the guy goes into this week-long slump, maybe you can see something. Or maybe he's dipping his shoulder. He's not taking that good level swing. He's uppercutting the ball. And unconsciously, a lot of ball players do that because you get stale. You play every day, and you get stale, and you get into little ruts. And you don't notice it. You think you're doing the same identical thing, but you're not. So a coach can sit back and watch, observe that. And then the next day, mention to him, Charlie, you're dropping your shoulder. You know, you're overstriding. You're not waiting for the ball to get to the plate. Little tricks of spread out. where you can't lunge. You almost got to hit it flat-footed. That works sometimes. But I don't know. From what I gather about the player today, I don't know, the batting coaches and the catching coaches and so on, I don't really know if they have enough authority to really help a guy. You don't want to interfere with him. This kid gets a little upset mentally and thinks that you shouldn't be telling him all that. What the hell, he goes up to front office and all you are trying to do is help the guy. And maybe you're giving him, he don't like it. I don't know, I've heard some nightmarish stories about today, but I had Wally Moses. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wally Moses, the old peepsight, he was fantastic. I really enjoyed him. He helped me to no end.
Was there a specific pitch that you hit better than others?
Fastball.
Fastball hitter?
Yeah. And don't kid yourself. Every ball player in the big leagues today loves the fastball. Yeah. A lot of them will say, well, no, I'd rather hit the curveball. Don't you believe that. Don't you believe that. I remember a good friend of mine, Tommy Heinrich. Now, Tommy goes way back. Mm-hmm. Well, Tommy couldn't hit a curveball, but nobody knew it. And Tommy had his mind and his reflexes all geared for a fastball. And he automatically would take the curveball, see? And he said, and now he talks about it. Of course, you don't talk about it when you're playing. But hell, he said he would take two curveballs for a strike and then hit the fastball. Nobody noticed it. Tommy had good years.
He did?
Yeah, he did. Mm-hmm. But that fastball, buddy, that's the one to jump on.
Played against a lot of good pitchers. Anyone in particular that stands out that really gave you a hard time, or even a pitcher that might not have had as good a record but really seemed to have your number?
Joey, we don't have enough time on this tape for me to name the guys that had my number. I mean, I'll guarantee you that. I had an opportunity to bat against Herb Score. And, boy, that was good night, Irene. I only went to bat against him once. And that was enough. Dean Chance was tough, believe it or not. He was right-handed pitcher. And Dean hit the ball somehow, and he had that little sinking fastball, a little dabble, do ya? And, boy, he was tough. Dick Raddatz at Boston. Dick could be tough on you. Of course, Billy Pierce. You better put in their tape in there, pal. We're going to be here a long time.
What about fielding now? I know that you played a couple different positions, and you might not have played as much as you like, but do you think that some guys can get into a slump as far as fielding is concerned? You mentioned guys can get stale a little bit. Does that affect fielding also?
Oh, definitely, definitely. That's, gosh, you got to remember, you play 7 days a week. I know at one stretch there, we played 43 straight days without a day off. And, crap, we'd look up and there was one little tiny cloud off in the distance. We'd pray for it to come over and do a job on us. But, you get stale. You get into it. Sometimes the old saying goes, you can't see the trees from the forest. Well, that's exactly, you do that base running, you can do it playing defense. You do it hitting. And then that's when the manager's job, that's what he's paid to notice. And he said, Charlie, I'm going to give you a day off today. You just take it easy and regroup.
Playing a couple different positions, do you have a basic strategy that allows you to be ready at a moment's notice for any of the different ones, or did you take each one as it came, each position?
Well, no, you never know. You never knew from 1 minute to the next when the old man would say, you go to right field, you go left field, or you catch. You never knew, so it didn't make any difference. I could butcher the outfield just as well as I could behind the plate. So I didn't have any pressure on me. I was lousy going in. But once in a while, I could help you with a glove. Like once. in 10 years.
What umpires do you remember? Being a catcher, maybe you had a couple of incidences where the umpires maybe didn't see things your way. Anything stand out in your mind there, either favorably or negatively, umpires for you?
Well, yeah. Well, being a catcher, now, you know, you didn't want to say too much, because that's the last guy in the ballpark that you want, you know, to make his S list. You make his S list, and it's going to be a long day for you. So you didn't give him too bad a time. And believe it or not, sometimes he'd call a ball, and then I'd throw the ball back, and I'd Frank Eumont was a good friend of mine. I'd say, Frank, you missed that. Well, he said, geez, yeah. He said, I agree. You know, he'd agree. And then sometimes it would hit the corner, and it was a strike. And then he'd ask me. He said, he'd call the ball, he'd say, did I miss that? And I'm going to say, yeah, you did, Frank. You know, they're human beings, too, and they're not out there to tap you. No. But what the heck, you know, they rotate, you know, mm-hmm. every 4 days. And behind the plate, can you imagine calling 150 pitches? And I don't think there'll ever be an umpire alive that called 150 right, the right way, you know.
Sure.
But you just hope and pray they don't call you a ball four with the bases loaded in the ninth inning, you know.
Sure, I understand that. John, what was your most memorable game?
Well,
if you have one that stands out.
Well, yeah, we were playing Cincinnati in the 61 World Series. Mm-hmm. And on the first game, I think it was, you guys have to look it up, but I was 0 for 4 against Joey J. And I took a nice sweet 0 for 4. I think I had three ground balls and a pop-up. Real nice collar. Well, at least I went home and I told my wife, I said, I had my chance. I started a ball game in the World Series. And I can tell the kids that the rest of my life. I said, because I don't think I'm coming back. But it was difficult to see in Yankee Stadium in the fall of the year. You know, the shadow come between the mound and home plate. And that's no excuse. That's a fact. And that's all it was to it. Next day, O'Toole pitched, I think it was. And I didn't play. And then, let me see, we wind up in Cincinnati a couple of games later, and so I resigned myself to the fact that I wasn't going to play again. So then I go out there, and Tony Kubek came over to me, and he said, geez, the old man, Huff put the lineup card up there. And I said, well, he says, he got you batting fourth against Joey J, the same guy that gave me a collar. And I said, well, you're kidding. Tony was good at that, practical joking. I never batted cleanup in my life with the Yankee ball club. So anyway, well, that was true story. So then, you know, funny, Joe, I thought that as long as Hulk had that kind of confidence in me, I don't know, something snapped upstairs, and I gave a little extra. And gosh, I had a super day. First time up, I hit a two-run homer off him. And then I hit a single, and then I got a double, and then I walked, and then I got on base and an error. I was on base five times. But during World Series time, they never mentioned that. Well, yeah, they always talk about these other big turkeys that were on base. Went to bat five times, got on base five times in a World Series game. So my boys at home, you know, are watching, and they're waiting, well, Dad, you did that? And I said, yeah, man, they forgot about me. But I had a good day that day, and I threw a guy. Let me see. Well, I thought I threw somebody out at third base, but that was probably the biggest day. And that was the first and last time, Joe, that I ever batted cleanup.
On the other side of the coin, do you have one there that sticks out as a particularly worst day of your career?
Uh-huh. Again, you got any more tape?
If we need it, I'll go into the back.
I had some. I dropped... Let me see, I dropped a fly ball. Oh, I was playing right field against a dive. No, I didn't drop that one. It stuck in the web. I should have dropped it. I thought it went through my web. I just had a lot of 0 for 4 days. Mm-hmm. I had 0 for 5s and, you know, 0 for 3s. I had a couple of errors, you know. There's nothing worse than having a couple of errors and then going 0 for 4 and maybe strike out 2 or 3 times. And, I had numerous days like that.
What was it like, John, playing in New York at that point in time? Team was one of the greatest teams of all time. Tell me a little bit about just your experiences being in New York and being with that team at that time in history.
Well, I think that when all is said and done, I think that the best thing that ever happened to me, the happiest day I ever had, was just being a Yankee. Now, that might sound a little mushy, and they might, you know, people, they've heard that for many years, but there's no doubt in my mind or the minds of my ballplayer friends that it felt the same way. Just being on that with the pinstripes, that was the biggest thrill an athlete could have. There's no question about it. Well, just being there and being a part of that 61 ball club, that was... Gosh, you know, we knew we had a good ball club, but it seems like, Joe, that after you're out of the game a while and you look back, you see, and then you read the stats and all the numbers the guys got, and you say, my God, we had a great ball club. You know, we were good, and we put it all together. So that was a big, big thrill.
Let's talk a little bit about 1961. You had a what has to be considered an outstanding year, 21 homers, 302 average, 305 average, part of the team that set the record for most home runs in the season, which still stands, and as you said, had a great, I think, won 109 games and swept a fairly decent Cincinnati team in the series. Tell me a little bit about the team and about your year that year. What really got you off to the good start and kept you going through the whole year?
Well, you know, I think that, like, Yogi had 21 home runs. I had 21. Elsenhar had 22. And the Moose had a great year. Skarin mm-hmm. had a great year. Super. You know, we got caught up. I think we all got caught up in the Maris Mantle run for 60. And believe it or not, Joey, that took all the pressure off of everybody. All the pressure of that season was 100% on Mickey and Whitey's shoulder, or Mickey and Roger's shoulders. And as a result, because they were going so good, that I really think that the rest of us, I don't know, it might have did something to us upstairs, because everybody, the bench, the pitching staff, the fielding, and the hitting, everybody had to put it all together. And I really think that the pressure was on them and not us. I enjoyed it to no end, you know. Jesus, that was really something to be witnessed, to be around. And I think that a lot of it had to do with the pressure of the everyday was all on their shoulders. Nobody was paying attention to us, and we would just go ahead and have good years.
What was your relationship with the press when you were playing ball? Was it...